This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Dan Cardin's the chief political reporter for the Times of Northwest Indiana in Northwest Indiana, and he joins us on occasion to talk about various stories that he's put out in print and online, and he is with us once again today to cover some of the major political stories here in the region. Dan, thanks for being on today.
Happy to be here.
Well, let's start first with a kind of an update on the final filling of a permanent, I guess you could say, U.S. Attorney for Northern Indiana. We've finally gotten it through Congress, through the Senate at least, and the person is now officially in the job at least. Tell us a little bit more about Clifford Johnson and the position he's now taken.
Yeah, well, he should be a familiar face to anybody who's interacted with the U.S. Attorney's Office. He's been there in various roles since 1986. He was the top civil litigator in the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Northern District of Indiana since 2010, and he was briefly U.S. Attorney during a period between the Obama and Trump presidencies when there wasn't a Senate-appointed U.S. Attorney. He was the number two guy in the local office, and he ended up being acting U.S. Attorney during the prosecution of Lake County Sheriff John Buntzich. Mm-hmm. So he has a lot of experience in the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Northern District. It serves the top third of the state, including Northwest Indiana, South Bend, all the way over to Fort Wayne. And obviously it's an important job. He's one of 93 federal prosecutors in the entire country. And, you know, he's overseeing prosecutions for, you know, all sorts of federal crimes across the entire district.
Yes, he's certainly very, very knowledgeable on the issues involving crime, and in particular trying to deal with things like the drug traffic that comes through Northwest Indiana on a regular basis, the weapons that seem to flow from Northwest Indiana into other places, including Chicago. So he's very, very capable of handling the battles against all of those. So he's well suited for this job, to be sure. And as you mentioned before, he's served before as an interim U.S. attorney for Northern Indiana. So he's not a new guy to the job.
Yeah, and he's a region guy. He's originally from Gary. He got his law degree at Valparaiso. He did work briefly for the Justice Department in Washington, D.C. After college, but then came right back to Northwest Indiana and has been working in the U.S. Attorney's Office the whole time since then. So you couldn't find probably a more prepared person with the experience in the office to lead the office at this time. Also, you know, as an aside, he's the first black U.S. attorney mm-hmm. in Northern Indiana. President Biden also appointed Zachary Myers, who was confirmed by the Senate. He's the first black U.S. attorney in Southern Indiana. He's the son of the 2020 Democratic candidate for governor, Dr. Woody Myers, who was unsuccessful in his run for governor, but his son ended up getting appointed mm-hmm. as U.S. attorney. So very historic nominations and appointments to these important federal roles.
And we know that things are going to be well in hands as far as the U.S. Attorney's Office here in Northern Indiana is concerned with having the new attorney, an old hand, we should say, but new in the official job, at least, of being U.S. Attorney Clifford Johnson. One of the other stories you had out in print and online, in fact, is it's going on actually as we speak, in a way, is going to be someone who will be chosen, at least amongst the precinct committee people, to fill the vacancy that State Senator Karen Talion is leaving on the Indiana Senate. Will you fill us in about the process in particular and about the people who are interested in her position?
Yeah, so Senator Talion, who served in the Senate for the past 16 years, has decided to end her tenure, decided to resign on November 1st. So there is a caucus to fill the vacancy that's actually happening tonight in Chesterton. The leaders of the Democratic Party leaders in each of the precincts in the district, which is, I'd say, the northern third of Border County and probably the northwest corner of LaPorte County, are gathering tonight, and they're going to pick one of five candidates to fill the vacancy that Talion's resignation is creating. And this person will finish the last year remaining in Talion's term and presumably run in the general election next year for the primary and the general election for the for a four-year term in 2022.
Mm-hmm.
And Oh, go ahead.
I was going to ask you if you would run down the list of the five people who have decided that they would like to be a U.S. excuse me, an Indiana senator.
Yeah, it's a pretty diverse group. Deborah Chubb from Michiana Shores is a Michigan City School Board member. She also runs a group that recruits and trains Democratic women to run for the Indiana General Assembly. So this is a perfect opportunity for her to live what she does. Mm-hmm. Todd Connor from Michigan City is a military veteran who runs a lot of veteran entrepreneur groups. And he's also the new CEO of Veterans for Political Innovation, which is trying to reduce political polarization and dysfunction in the United States. He doesn't currently have any office, but he's a U.S. Navy veteran. Michael Cooper, the pastor of a LGBTQ church in Portage. He's been very outspoken on human rights issues at the local and state level. Becky Mateja Lombardini of Chesterton is actually a precinct committee person, so she actually has the opportunity to vote for herself tonight. But she's been involved in Democratic politics in the region for a while. And Rodney Pohl Jr. of Chesterton, the attorney for the city of Gary, and he's actually the person that Senator Talian has endorsed to succeed her. But it will be up to these precinct committee people to decide who actually advances or who actually gets chosen and finishes the year left in Senator Talian's term.
I suppose, though, that if you have the endorsement of the person who's leaving office, it probably must count for something. But as you mentioned, it's going to be up to all of the precinct committee people in the district to make the actual decision and choose somebody.
Right. Yeah, and you know, Senator Talian obviously knows these precinct committee people because she's been representing them in the Senate for the last 16 years. So, you know, her endorsement likely will go a long way. But there are, you know, four other people that these committee people will have to look at and consider. And, you know, there's always sort of the Porter County versus LaPorte County thing. The bulk of the population is in Porter County, but, you know, two of these candidates come from LaPorte County. So mm-hmm. maybe they want to, you know, get somebody from over there. So we'll find out. We should find out tonight who's going to win. Who is selected by this caucus, and
right.
that person will become a senator on November 1st.
Now, certainly, whoever is selected is going to be getting to work pretty soon. I guess the person will take over for Senator Talian on November 1st, and lawmakers are going to be getting together pretty soon, I guess not long after that, to at least kind of get things prepared for the next session coming up in January.
I know. Well, technically, we haven't even adjourned the 2021 session.
No, that's true.
They came back and did the redistricting last month, but didn't formally end the session just in case there was a problem with the redistricting and they needed to come back and fix it. So I've never seen this happen. I've been covering the Indiana General Assembly 12 years now,
mm-hmm.
and this is something that they do in Illinois where they run one session into the next one quite a bit, but I've never seen this happen in Indiana, so I'm guessing they're just going to come in November 16th on Organization Day, you know, come in at 11:30 to end the 2021 General Assembly and bang the gavel again at noon to start the 2022 General Assembly.
Well, we'll see if that does happen, to be sure.
Yeah.
And maybe it's worth mentioning, too, for folks that have forgotten about the stories about Senator Talian deciding to step down when she made her announcement. She had some very definite reasons why she didn't want to continue on in the Indiana Senate.
Yeah, and she's spoken about this, that, you know, she just doesn't feel like there's much she can get done there in this year remaining because the Senate is dominated by the Republican Party. The Republicans have 39 of the 50 seats. Democrats are largely marginalized on policy debates. They try to propose amendments to Republican legislation moving through the chamber, but those often fail mm-hmm. on party line votes. Senator Talian thinks she can put her background and experience towards other goals right now, and so that's why she said she's resigning. Yeah. You know, going back, she also came into the Senate when Roseanne Antic resigned from the Senate to become Maryville Clerk Treasurer, and Talian finished the last year remaining in her term. She was caucused in. So, you know, and she might be looking out for her possible successor and have that person run as an incumbent in 2022 rather than just the Democratic nominee.
Oh, good point. We'll have to see if that actually does happen. One of the other stories you had out recently here in the Times talks about one of our U.S. senators, Mike Braun, and he is going across the state line encouraging people from Illinois to come work in Indiana. And there's a reason why. Will you go into that, please?
Well, it's a very specific group of people. You know, Indiana has always encouraged people from Illinois to move over to Indiana and, you know, enjoy the lower taxes and better quality of life and everything else they tout during those campaigns. But Senator Braun specifically is reaching out to Chicago police officers, some of whom are in danger of losing their jobs because they've so far refused to comply with Chicago's vaccine mandate that applies to all city employees. The mayor in August directed all City of Chicago employees to get fully vaccinated against COVID-19 by October 15th. Many have, but only about two-thirds of the police officers in Chicago have. So they are being instructed, directly ordered to get the vaccine, and those that are refusing are being put on no-pay status as the potential prelude to getting fired. And Senator Braun is reaching out to them saying he's ready to connect those guys to Indiana Police Department that's hiring if they end up losing their jobs due to the Chicago COVID vaccine requirement.
And I know you did talk to some police officers, police chiefs at least here in Indiana about that, and some have already been on the Chicago media talking about it too, I understand.
Yeah, this is, they've, you know, just like everybody else right now, Indiana Police Departments say that they have employee shortages. They need to hire police officers, so they're looking at it if we can get an experienced police officer who's already been through the police academy, who's already been trained, who's been on the job for several years. That's an advantage to these Indiana police agencies that they don't have to recruit and hire and train more people. They can just bring in these Chicago folks without too much effort.
Mm-hmm. One of the other stories you had out here recently talks about the latest involving whether there's going to be a South Suburban Chicago casino in Illinois and what kind of impact, of course, that's going to have on the Northwest Indiana casinos. And that's something, I guess, is a continuing story as well, too, because we've gotten some changes in the list, but it's not complete yet. Will you tell us about that?
Yeah. There's four cities in the South Suburban Cook County applied for this new casino license that was created in 2019. The Illinois Gaming Board has really taken their time moving on this thing. If just as a point of reference, the Illinois Gaming Board, the Illinois Legislature created this new casino license for the South Suburbs 1 month after the Indiana Legislature authorized the move of the Gary Casino from the Lakeshore to a land-based location. And Gary has already, you know, built a Hard Rock Casino. It's already been open for 6 months, and, you know, it's, doing great business. So it's an interesting contrast in terms of how fast things can get done in Indiana versus maybe a little bit less fast in Illinois.
Mm-hmm.
So the two finalists now are, they've eliminated, the Gaming Board decided yesterday to eliminate Calumet City and Linwood. And that leaves the casino plans for Homewood and Matson as the two finalists for this South Suburban gaming license. And fortunately for Northwest Indiana, Homewood and Matson locations are the farthest from Indiana. The Calumet City one would have been at River Oaks Mall just across the state line. Same with the Linwood one. It was just right at Illinois 394, just east of Munster, or just west of Munster. So it would have been those would have been far more convenient for people living in Northwest Indiana to get to. Now the Northwest Indiana casinos only just have to watch for any potential Illinois people who might decide to go to Matson or Homewood instead of continuing eastward to one of the Northwest Indiana casinos they've been patronizing for the last 30 years.
Do you think that community members may have played a role over in Illinois into the gaming board's decision to eliminate, in this particular case, the Calumet City casino possibility?
Well, it was actually Linwood was the one that the Illinois Gaming Board was most concerned about.
Uh-huh.
The new mayor of Linwood was not a fan of the casino proposal when she served on the village board, and the Ho-Chunks that were from Wisconsin that were going to run the new casino in Linwood said that they, both the gaming board, they hadn't really been in contact with the mayor since she took office. So one of the things the chairman of the gaming board said yesterday was that they weren't convinced that there was sufficient community support for the casino in Linwood. That wasn't the case in Calumet City. The mayor of Calumet City was behind the project. The gaming board didn't really say why Calumet City got cut, because the law does allow them to have three finalists, and they only went with two. But the mayor of Calumet City also said he's not deterred by this. He's still got a big plan to redevelop the River Oaks area, and you know, the casino was part of that plan if it could be in there, but you know, he still wants to turn it into a major entertainment destination for the south suburbs, regardless of whether or not there's a casino.
Well, that'll keep the mayor busy trying to find something other than a casino to go into that space there. And as we know, there's plenty of room there, as you mentioned, around River Oaks to be able to locate something within that region. And we spent time here talking about not only things in Indiana, but Illinois as well, too. And Dan Carden, thank you very much for spending time with us talking about these stories that you've had out there in print and online in the Times recently.
Anytime.
You're welcome. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Jill Long Thompson is a former three-term congresswoman from Indiana. She's currently a college professor. In fact, she teaches ethics for the O'Neill and for the Kelly School of Businesses with Indiana University, primarily on the Bloomington campus. She's had a political career that went back to when she was first elected to office in the Valparaiso City Council. And that was 1983, and she in turn has, of course, served in the House of Representatives, served under the Bill Clinton administration before, and she's done a number of things. She's also run, she was the first nominated woman for either office of a major political party here in Indiana when she was running for governor. That was back in 2008. And she has most recently written a book published by the Indiana University Press entitled The Character of American Democracy. And Jill Long Thompson, thank you for joining us on Lakeshore Public Radio.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Let me ask this, I think, very simple question, but it'll lead into a lot of others. The first question I was thinking of as I was putting together my notes was, does this book, which again is titled The Character of American Democracy, does it require knowing a lot about politics and ethics, or can someone learn them from it? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think that the book probably would have relevance to a broad audience. And if you're someone who hasn't thought a great deal about the role that ethics play in running a democratic government, I think it would provide some insight. But I also think if you have experience, it would clarify and maybe confirm some things. But no, you do not have to have a background in politics. You don't have to be taking a course in political science. I think if you care about our democracy and you care about our country and love the country as I do, I think you might find it to be an interesting read. And I say that not because I'm wanting to sell lots of books for myself. I have directed that all of the royalties go back to Indiana University.
That's good.
I believe very strongly in education, and Indiana University really changed the trajectory of my career. And I want to be able to provide some help for other students as they are coming along many years behind when I was there.
I noted that you begin the book talking a lot about the importance of character, and personal and professional in that particular case. You mentioned about some veterans that you managed to grow up around as a young person, and the importance that they held in, I guess, character. Tell us some thoughts about that.
Well, I think the willingness and the courage that it takes to serve in the military, to literally put your life on the line, to protect our democracy, to protect the values of our country, I think that that says a great deal about a young man or woman's character. And I grew up on a farm in rural Indiana in the 1950s and 60s. And literally everywhere I would go, there were veterans of World War II or of the Korean War. We went to church. Many of the members of our congregation were veterans. My dad is a veteran. I have uncles who are veterans. And these were, and my late mother-in-law served in England during World War II. These mm-hmm. were young people who, for the most part, had not traveled very far outside their counties. They grew up on farms. They stayed there and worked hard. And somewhere between the ages of 18 and 20 were drafted or volunteered to serve and went to very faraway places because of their belief. And there was a draft, but because of their belief in what we stand for here. And I just think they epitomize American character.
I know a lot gets mentioned these days about imperfect union, which, of course, is stated in the documents that you can go see if you wish to visit Washington. How is it linked to your book?
We can't expect that in order to have character that someone is perfect. Humans mm-hmm. are not perfect, and we have not been perfect in our history. The fact that we allowed slavery, and I attribute a great deal of that to just ignorance at the time, in addition to a self-serving approach to running the farms, the plantations, and so forth. We are not a perfect nation. You're not going to find a perfect nation. You're not going to find a perfect person. But on balance, we have worked to advance opportunities for minorities and women. And I think the country's loss of Congressman John Lewis, he has, I think he very much epitomizes what American character is.
Mm-hmm.
And he, by working with literally thousands of people over the years, was able to be a part of bringing the country forward. We have a long way to go. But we're striving for perfection, but we know that we will not be perfect. At the same time, we want to make sure that our leaders reflect the values that were incorporated into the U.S. Constitution. And not only is it important for our leaders to reflect those values of democracy, the values of fairness of process, equality of participation, transparency, individual rights, individual opportunity. It's important that we move those, that we take actions that support those things, recognizing that even when we do our best, we will falter from time to time, but we need to keep moving forward.
We're talking with former Congresswoman Jo Long Thompson. She's also run for other public office here in Indiana, and she's been involved in federal government as well, too, for a number of years. She's now teaching ethics at Indiana University in Bloomington. And I guess the question I'll ask you is a question you probably get and have to put in your syllabus for the classes when you teach them, is what does it mean to act ethically?
Ethics are not what people often associate them with. Oftentimes, when we think of ethics, we think of morality or religious beliefs or sometimes even feelings. Does something not feel right that we're about to do or that we see someone else doing? But actually, ethics are, I like this definition, well-based standards of right and wrong
mm-hmm.
that prescribe what people ought to do in terms of virtues, duties, and outcomes. And I also like to reference in my classes, and by the way, I'm not teaching this summer and I'm not going to be teaching this fall. I want to clarify that. I am going to be promoting the book this fall. So technically I am not teaching, and since I wrote a book on ethics, I have to be very transparent
well,
about that.
That's very fine. You're being ethical, that which is fine. That's something to learn. One of the other things I noted, too, in the book, as you refer to decision-making with character, would you briefly
yes.
explain what that is all about? And we have personal biases. We do. We try our best not to show them or not to let them affect us, but they are there anyway.
They are, and they're based on our own personal experiences and things that we have heard. Basically, they come from having limited experiences. So decision-making with character involved, and I borrow from the late Professor Hosmer from, he taught at the University of Michigan, and he used a sort of a three-pronged approach to making good decisions, where you look at whether or not something you're considering doing is virtuous. Does it reflect the duty that you have to others? In other words, is it principled? And then how does it affect people? And when you make a decision with character, you would identify the situation. What is the dilemma that you're facing? And then what alternatives do you have? And you would evaluate each alternative based on whether it's virtuous. And in a minute, I'll talk about virtues, mm-hmm. Whether it is principled. And if it's principled, it would be reflective of a duty that you have in the role that you're playing, the role as a parent, the role as a manager, the role as a driver in heavy traffic even. And then you would also evaluate how people would be impacted, what would be the positive and negative impacts. And in public service, in government in particular, the impact on people is very important. Now, regarding virtues, Aristotle was a virtue philosopher, and I'm not a philosopher, but I, many years ago, came across what are called the pillars of character, and these are widely accepted values that exist around the world and in various countries and cultures. And they include trustworthiness, which would include integrity, respect for others, responsibility, taking responsibility for our actions, fairness, and in democracy, fairness of process as well as fairness of outcome. Those are both important. Caring, do we have compassion for others? And then the final pillar is citizenship, meaning are we being a good citizen? Not are we formally a citizen of a particular country, but are we, by our actions and our attitudes, reflecting what a good citizen should do? And so trustworthiness, respect, responsibility, fairness, caring, mm-hmm. and citizenship.
I noticed in the book, too, that you bring up and talk in one of the points in the book about an essay that you happen to have read some time ago from economist Milton Friedman. And mm-hmm. I guess in turn how it seems to be a part of the study of ethics as it pertains to business. And you would think certainly in the 21st century that the two words ethics and business don't always go together or they almost conflict. How do you think that Dr. Friedman had kind of put things together that you thought it was worthy of putting in the book itself?
Well, he wrote the essay. It was back when I was an undergraduate student at Valparaiso University that it was published. Mm-hmm. And the essay's title was something like The Social Responsibility of Business is to Generate Profits for Its Owners. That's not the exact title, but that was the point. But in the essay, he made the point that you have this responsibility to run the business well. And to do so that those who invested and entrusted you with the management of the company, that they get a return on their investment. But he also said something along the lines of if society's values are such that it is in the interest of the business to reach out and have the social responsibility in any of a number of ways, then that should be incorporated. And I think that part of his essay was often overlooked, and it was the title that got most of the attention. Mm-hmm. I am a firm believer in capitalism, and as you know, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development does research on various economies. And over the last number of decades, capitalism has generated more income per capita multiple times over, actually, other economic forms. Capitalism works, but it has to be fair and regulated. And just as governments are run by people who are not perfect. Corporations and small businesses are run by people who are not perfect, because none of us are perfect. Mm-hmm. And that's why I think that we have to have smart, a smart regulatory system. And we do regulate here in the United States, but oftentimes it's more politically determined than economically or determined from a fairness standpoint. Regulated capitalism is the best way, I believe, to generate the income that's needed to run a successful country. You can't have an infrastructure or strong public education, strong health care, if you don't have an economy generating the resources to fund those things.
Now, I note in the book, and you bring this point up, I guess, even before you get to talking about Dr. Friedman, but it's an interesting point when you're dealing with the subject of trying to lead with character. And you bring up the example, and we're not here to push this particular restaurant chain that has this interesting policy, but you bring up as a good example of leadership with character about how a certain restaurant chain that operates out of the Midwest has a coffee refill policy. And there's an interesting way that you put that together. Tell us how this all came about and what kind of a way it helps maybe teach us a little ethics lesson.
Well, my mother and her cousin are Bonnie and Liz. And they grew up during the Depression, and they go to this restaurant regularly, or they were going to it regularly. They're not now during the pandemic. And my mother's cousin would always drive, and then my mother would buy lunch. And they would order one cup of coffee for the two of them, and my mother would drink the coffee, but then order a refill, because there were free refills at this restaurant. But she ordered the refill not for herself, but for her cousin, and she would very quietly and discreetly walk out of the restaurant with the cup of coffee in a to-go cup. And when they got to the car, she would hand it to her cousin. And they did that because they thought it was wasteful not to take that free cup of coffee, that free refill. And I told them that the refill, by definition, is for the person who ordered the first cup, not unlike if you go to an all-you-can-eat buffet. It's all you can eat, not all you and the rest of the people at your table can eat.
Uh-huh.
And so I believe that it's important to look at what they were doing in the context of trying to be smart money managers. At the same time, the outcome of that is, if everybody were to do that, it ends up raising the price of a meal or of coffee for, let's say, half of the people who would go to that restaurant. If they were to order the free refill and give it to someone else, that does increase the cost for that restaurant, and that cost has to be passed on to others. And so in terms of the impact on others, it is not probably the most character-driven decision you could make, but it also, there's a virtue issue, because integrity would dictate that you take the refill for yourself. Now, people argue this with me, and I am willing to accept those arguments, but it's just a simple example of how every day we're confronted with ethics dilemmas, and sometimes they're a little more complex than we think.
I know you close the book out, as you begin the book, in a way, with some quotes from the late Senator John Lewis, who we are remembering as a civil rights icon and a very, very responsible lawmaker. The route that he decided to take, rather than just being a protester, that he decided to work the system from within. But he mentions in this in the final quote about the strength of character and the strength of union. And he uses a particular phrase, pushing and pulling together. Will you bring us up to how you feel that's certainly appropriate in these times that we're all facing?
I think that democracy works best when we are willing to acknowledge that we individually don't have all the answers. It is not reasonable for me or anyone to think, I get my own senator, I get my own president, I get my own laws. We have to work together to advance the values and to move forward as a society, as a people. And we need to push and pull together. not expect to have our own way. And the word compromise has a negative connotation for some, but compromise is integral to successful democracy. And while, yes, each of us would like to have our way all the time, we think, for democracy to work, we have to be willing to compromise. And we need leaders who are not divisive in their approach, who are not divisive in their language. We need leaders who will bring people together who have different ideas, different points of view. You know, diversity, the research shows over and over again that when you have diversity in leadership, when you have people who come from different backgrounds, where you have gender diversity and ethnic diversity and racial diversity, that's when you get the best leadership, and that's when organizations perform the best. And I think that Congressman John Lewis was just so brilliant in his understanding of what it takes to make democracy work. And we do need to push and pull together, not expect to have our way, and not to divide and conquer. Dividing and conquering for the purpose of conquering and getting your own way makes us weaker as a nation. We need to embrace this concept of pushing and pulling together and compromising and working together toward our common goals and upholding our common values.
Indiana University professor Jill Long Thompson is a former three-term congresswoman from Indiana. She's also been a Democratic Party nominee for a U.S. Senate seat and also a nominee for governor back in 2008. And she has just put out a book published by the IU Press entitled The Character of American Democracy. And Professor Thompson, thank you for spending time with us to talk about the book, your thoughts about the issues of character and democracy. And we hope that many people have a chance to pick up the book and learn for themselves how you feel about this as well.
Thank you very much for this opportunity. I'm honored and enjoyed the interview. Thank you.
That's it for Regionally Speaking for today and for this week. Our thanks not only to Jill Long Thompson for talking with us, but also to Times Chief Political Reporter Dan Carton for bringing us up to date on the stories that he's put out in print and online recently. And we thank you for joining us on the program today, and we'll be back with you on Monday.